Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Welcome, and very nice to have you with us. In the show today, we have more on the notion held by some that the Weymouth, Portland and the Chesil area should split from the county council, which is said to ignore the area and its residents. Torchester fares no better, it seems, and town councillor Alistair Chisholm is live in our studio to add his views on the subject of UDI. Nearly 4,000 Dorset children and young people have been referred to the county's mental health professionals and clinics in recent months. Why? A transformational life coach and psychotherapist Gemma Levitas throws some light on the subject.
And our gardening expert Ruth Hayes has some advice about growing tomatoes. Motoring history. We turn the spotlight, quite literally, on cat's eyes. Who invented them? And the invention of traffic lights that ended with a bang. Pedestrian crossings, and we have a warning to people hiring cars at holiday destinations in Europe. Rapacious car hire companies are charging up to £224 to sanitise their vehicles against COVID.
We make no apologies for returning to the subject of UDI, the issue of Weymouth, Portland and the Chesil area making a unilateral declaration of independence from the newish Dorset Council. Listeners will be familiar with the views of town councillors, namely that the county authority ignores locally held views on such areas as planning and dictates what is to happen without consultation. Installations of Weymouths on the Weymouth Harbour side are but one irritant. There are other, many more important issues. From our archives, we go back 3 years at the time when the unitary authority was about to come into being. And here is what Weymouth and Borough Councillor David Harris had to say 3 years ago. Councillor David Harris, I've got a question for you. We all know about Brexit, but what about Rexit? This business of giving away the town's crown jewels, and you've made a call for councillors and presumably residents to kick against this, to say no. You can't have everything in unitary authority. We want some of those things ourselves. But isn't it a bit too late?
No, I hope it's not too late. There's still a battle to be fought to try and get some of those changes made that are necessary to enable Weymouth to flourish as a town on its own. But I think that the main issue is that we've been given some things to have for ourselves, but they all cost money to operate and to run.
Let's enumerate then, shall we? What have we been offered?
We've been offered to be able to run events on the beach, to be able to manage our parks and gardens, although not all of them. One or two parks and gardens are only going to be given to us on a leasehold because they may be developed later on.
But don't they belong to the town?
Of course they belong to the town. The town has developed them. The town was given the seafront properties by relatives of King George III. So some of these things are very much part of the town and part of the fabric of the town. And so they do belong to the residents of Weymouth, and they should be there for our safekeeping for the future.
So what other things are we talking about?
Well, some of the things that we're talking about that can bring in income, let's take the town running an event on the beach. Brings in visitors. It will cost the town money because the town will have to pay the Dorset Waste Partnership to collect up the additional litter that's created. The town will have to have asked the unitary authority to close some of the roads for the event that might be taking place. So it will all have cost residents money to bring those extra visitors in for that event. Those visitors will pay into the car parks. The town will get none of that money back. So why should we be doing things to help the benefit of the town when we don't gain from any of those activities? The town should be getting incomes from car parks. It should be allowed to give discounts to its own residents if it wants to use those car parks in a different way. It should be allowed to make the decisions about whether to make those car parks free for Christmas shoppers. All those sorts of things should be the decisions of the town, not of a unitary council that has responsibility for the services that it has to offer to social services, to children's services. Those are the things which the unitary council should be involved in, not the managing of the day-to-day affairs of a town like Weymouth.
Now, let's take Weymouth's real estate. Weymouth owns a lot of bed and breakfasts and small hotels. What's happened to those?
Well, they've been taken over by the unitary council. They provide an income of something like £1 million a year, and that's after costs have been taken out for managing them. And so these, again, can be used or sold by the unitary council to pay for the public services it should be getting the money from the government to pay for, and instead it is the Weymouth citizens, and of course we all know that Weymouth is one of the poorest authorities in the whole of the country. It has one of the lowest sets of wages. It has one of the lowest social mobilities. If it can't actually support itself, then that situation could get even worse.
So, I mean, are we actually saying that Weymouth has been beggared?
It has certainly had some of its crown jewels removed, and its opportunities for supporting itself to grow when it's been released from the shackles of the County Council. It should have been given the opportunity to grow itself and to get back the pride that it used to have as a town and a borough in the late 20th century.
Well, now, that was David Harris 3 years ago. Now, let's fast forward to what David Harris, who is now the leader of Weymouth Town Council, told Ridgeway magazine this week about a possible development on the subject of the Weymouth, Portland and Chesil area having more to say in decision making.
David Harris, can I put a thought to you which came from a councillor on the Dorchester Town Council, and also it was mentioned to me by one of your colleagues, and that was, why don't Dorchester and Weymouth get together and form a unitary authority apart from the county council? Does that seem like an idea?
Well, it's certainly one worth considering if we aren't able to get a better operation happening than is happening at the moment. All avenues have to be tried and tested, because certainly the system isn't working as it should. The communication channels are not working. The ability to get things moving for the residents of this part of the county is not happening. So it is certainly something worth considering. But there are other options we can consider, and I think that they must all be looked at together as we move forward.
Now, you mentioned the Chesil Partnership to me last time we spoke, and I don't know very much about it. Can you just put me in the picture as to a little bit more as to what it is?
Yes, it's an interesting activity that the Dorset Council has created. It's bringing together different teams of staff in the children's services section, who are then working very closely together to try and support the families that are in greatest need. So that's the children and the parents of families that have greatest needs, which may come from all sorts of different reasons. So it could be from health, from one-parent families, or whatever. Now, the interesting thing is that here is a good operation happening, but when I was talking to my colleagues on Dorset Council who represent Weymouth, unfortunately, none of them knew anything about it. So it's something which may be a good thing, but it's not involving the councillors yet. The leader of Dorset Council says very clearly that we should be using our Dorset councillors to get information if we want it as town and parish councils. But if they don't know what's happening, because they're not even kept in touch, then that makes life very difficult.
So it seems like a lack of communication all round, then.
Well, there is. Yes, it's extremely difficult to actually find out what is happening from Dorset Council and how it affects our residents.
Now, we've talked about the idea, well, it's not really an idea, it's probably a dream, actually, of Dorchester and Weymouth and surrounding areas possibly declaring UDI. What about places like Poole and Christchurch and Bournemouth? I mean, they are obviously urban, and it has been said that the bulk of the, shall we say, sentiment of the county council seems to be for rural areas. I mean, how do they feel about the way that they're treated?
Well, I certainly know from colleagues who live in that part of the council area that the Poole and Christchurch in particular feel that they're getting a rum deal sometimes. And they were certainly very nervous about joining. I believe, I don't know the details, but I believe that there were even a group of Conservative councillors on Christchurch who actually declared UDI from their colleagues because they opposed what was happening. So, you know, there are certainly some issues that that the unitary authorities have created that have not yet been solved.
So I think this is a story that's going to run and run, don't you?
I think there's plenty of mileage in it yet, and I hope we'll be looking at ways forward and improvements over the next 12 months.
Well, we'll keep in touch, and thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, listening to that interview is Dorchester Town Councillor Alistair Chisholm. Is it true to say Dorchester Town Councillors share Weymouth's concern at the lack of voice on the County Council? Now, you're famous for making yourself heard. So here we are, Alistair. What is your take on the situation?
I think Councillor Harris is absolutely correct. I think there has been a failure of communication between the new unitary authority and particularly the larger parishes. Because we are classed as a town council, as a parish. We're, you know, we're no more important than that, even though, in the case of Weymouth and Dorchester, we're representing thousands of people. There has been a breakdown in communication, and it's interesting his referring to, you know, are there other options? And you mentioned UDI, which may be more of a dream than a reality. But my belief is that the cause of the problem, the root of the problem, is that when the unitary authority was formed 2 years ago, they opted to have a one-party cabinet system. So the cabinet is made up of 10 members of the Tory party, of the Conservative party, who make all the fundamental decisions. They have created something called advisory panels. The clue is in the word advisory. The final decisions are all taken by the Conservative councillors, who only just have over half the council, so that lots of views and opinions on various issues never get heard and certainly don't get put into the mix before the final decision. And in West Dorset, as some of your listeners will remember, just before they were turned into the we had a vote on the system. Was it to be the cabinet system, or would we prefer more democracy through the committee system? And there was an overwhelming vote in a referendum in West Dorset for the committee system. And I was cautiously optimistic that the new unitary authority might have learnt that lesson. And I was never sadder than watching at the first meeting, and every single member of the cabinet came from only one party. And I think that's the cause of the problems. We've had, for example, the lack of joined-up thinking. I understand why Dorset Council are struggling to keep the tourist information centres going. Dorchester Tourist Information Centre, which is now closed, was closed at a time when, for the last 2 years, Dorchester Town Council has had as one of its priorities making more of its stories and its heritage and its cultural associations and so on. What a time to close the tourist... No joined-up thinking. There's no... And then you think of that most amusing incident earlier this year, when we were fighting to challenge the development north of Dorchester. And as a town, a group of us decided it would be good to draw people's attention to the public consultation that was taking place on the local plan. And we put a very inoffensive banner across our main street, South Street. The next day, almost, the county council, or rather Dorset Council, came along and took it down. who should have the final word on what banners can or cannot be put across Dorchester or Weymouth or Bridport or Wimborne? Surely we must have some dignity and some authority at that level, and it's not happening. And it's really sad.
Could I ask you a question? Let's put some figures on this. How many county councillors are there?
There are 82 in all, and I think I'm right in saying, and Andy's here, very good with statistics, he'll be able to check it out for you. I'm pretty sure there are something like 45 Conservatives, so they have a majority, I think, currently of 4, which is not terribly convincing, and yet every decision is made by a cabinet made up entirely of Conservative members.
And what proportion of those councillors come from Weymouth and Dorchester?
It's interesting. Well, I mean, we have 5 councillors for Dorchester, and they presumably have a similar, if not slightly greater, number from Weymouth. But if they are not members of the Conservative Party, they don't really get a look in. As I say, they are invited to join these advisory panels, but that's just advice, not decision-making.
Would you disagree with this figure? Weymouth and Dorchester, something like 30% of the population of Dorset, represented by 1/10 of the number of councillors for Dorset. Does that sound right to you?
It could well be right, and I know you do your homework, John, so I don't have any doubt. I'm not going to quibble with that. But there is it's not proportional. It's not democratic. And I think some of the issues... I mean, that was a classic, wasn't it, about the railings in... Why can't you consult the very people who live there, who work there, whose existence... Just ask them what they think. Don't impose things. We live... I like to think, a free country, and we respect the views of local people. After all, Dorset Council are spending our money. They couldn't do a thing without us. So a little more respect shown to the population of Dorchester, a great deal more consultation on various issues, could avoid some of these, what's the French for it, a faux pas.
Oh, lovely, faux pas.
Faux pas is a nice word, now, is it? Yep.
Now, let's go back a little while, because a couple of years ago, you were on the programme and you were talking about the viability of an independent council, like they have in Frome. They're all independents and seems to work quite well, doesn't it?
I think it works extremely well. I'm an independent town councillor, and there are some on Dorset Council and in other town councils, and we are independent. Our only focus is to represent the people who elect us, and views vary amongst us, but what we seek to do is what is best for the people that have voted us in. We do not have a sort of a mantra or a central policy that we all have to adhere to slavishly, regardless of the situation we're in or the place we represent, which gives us a great deal more freedom to respond to the needs of the community. And Frome has done that superbly, and they're all independents.
Do you think there's any traction then in the fact of Dorchester and Weymouth getting together to try and form some kind of bond against the intrusive nature of the county council?
It's a most interesting idea, and although there's a wonderful friendly rivalry between Dorchester and Weymouth, actually we need to work together. And that classic thing in the summer when it finally arrives, it was a lovely sunny day, there's nobody in Dorchester, they're all on the beach in Weymouth, and then it clouds over, it gets a bit sort of drizzly, and they come to Dorchester because of all our indoor attraction. We are, what's the word, linked. And we're linked, and we need to be treated as one. And I think that's an interesting idea. But I think it would be better to pursue what I see as the fundamental cause, which is this one-party cabinet system. We would need 15,000 votes in a petition to trigger a referendum on how Dorset Council runs itself. And it could be run taking into account far more views than it is at present. And that narrowness of view leads to many of the problems that Councillor Harris mentioned and that the people of Dorchester and elsewhere in the county are suffering, no more so than through the extraordinary local plan. But we're not discussing that at the moment.
Right. Alistair, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio today. This, I think, is a hot potato.
Absolutely. Thank you again, John.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
Now then, it's a very quick changeover, hopefully, because we have our second guest in the studio. And it's time to take a rest from political hot potatoes and turn to gardening. And I don't know if we're turning to potatoes. Probably not. It might be something else, I think. But our guest, Ruth Hayes from Amateur Gardening Magazine, is here in the studio. So she's barely had time to take a breath, but Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to be back. Yeah. Nice to be back in the studio.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. And it says on my script, what's in your wheelbarrow full of advice today?
Right, well, we're not going to talk about potatoes, but we are going to be talking about the close relative, the tomato, because everybody likes to grow tomatoes in the summer. You know, they're that the garden centre supermarkets are full of them. And to be fair, homegrown tomatoes knock the socks off supermarket ones, which are always so absolutely hard and tasteless. Yep. And yep, especially, you know, in the winter because they've been frozen and brought in from abroad. But so, yeah, we're going to be talking about growing tomatoes.
Excellent, excellent.
Yes.
What else is going on in the garden at this time of year that people should be doing?
Well, I mean, we've got the long weekend coming up, the bank holiday, so I'm going to be catching up on jobs that I haven't been able to get on with because of the weather. We were lucky enough to get away for a few days last week. So I'm going to be doing a lot of planting and weeding because, frankly, the garden looks a bit like a jungle at the moment, Andy.
You're not alone there. You should come and see mine. Well, no, you shouldn't come and see mine, really. It's a mess.
Can't be as bad as ours. Can't be as bad. So, yes, but one of the jobs I will be doing this weekend is planting out my tomatoes. And because it's been so miserable, they've just been sitting in the greenhouse. And some of them will stay there, and then some will go in grow bags against a nice, warm, sheltered, sunny wall, which is what they like. And then the ones in the greenhouse will also be in their grow bags, and hopefully this year we'll get a good crop. I mean, if they're given the right care and you don't just leave them alone, they are pretty reliable. But everyone loves growing them, but they do have their little quirks. They can be slightly prima donna-ish. they are prone to pests and disease. So, and indoor ones and outdoor ones have different problems. So I thought I could just talk you through how to care for your tomatoes.
Yes, please do.
And get the best crop. I mean, first of all, they like lots of food and regular watering. Very often grow bags, they're quite flat, so before you plant them, it's best, if you're using grow bags, shake your grow bags up a bit, or even better, when you cut the little squares where the plants go, put a plant pot in there, cut out the bottom of the plant pot, put it in the grow bag and fill it up with a bit more compost and put your tomato in that, because otherwise the grow bags will soon run out of oomph and they'll use up all the nutrients.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one way of doing it, or just plant them up in big pots and keep watering, because one of the big problems we get with tomatoes, we get so many readers writing into Amateur Gardening about this, is if you don't keep them steadily watered, they're very prone to a condition called blossom end rot, which is when they sort of grow quite flat with hard little black bits on the bottom. And this is caused by a lack of calcium, because although soil and compost contains enough calcium, if there's not enough water, not enough is taken up to the plants. So water your plants daily if needs be in very dry periods, and just touch the compost to make sure, you know, that it's still damp. And the other thing to do is as they start to grow, you'll have your main stem and then the main shoots coming off with flowers, which then set into what we call the trusses of tomatoes, whether they're cherry ones or the big ones. Very often you get little shoots growing up in between the main stem and the main branch. get rid of these because they'll just take energy, they won't do much. Or an alternative is to let them grow to a few inches long, pinch them out, and then dip them in hormone rooting powder or compound gel and pot them up in seed compost, and you'll get a later crop of tomatoes because they will grow into late fruiting tomato plants.
Excellent.
So there you go.
I see. But I always have trouble with tomatoes. I've never really satisfactorily cracked. I mean, are they temperamental?
They like food. They like high potassium food, like your Tomerite or Big Tom that you can get.
Banana skins?
Banana skins, they're good for ripening off. If they're not ripening, hang a banana in your greenhouse
good
and
gracious.
They will ripen off.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, or what I do if I've got a load of green ones, although I do make green tomato chutney, is I put the green ones in a drawer with a banana after I've harvested them, and they'll ripen up and they'll be usable.
Well.
Because bananas give off a gas, I think it's ethanol, I always get this wrong, and that encourages ripening. Yeah.
Like, it's amazing. I've also been told that banana skins are good for roses.
I hadn't heard that one.
Well, you ask my roses.
Is that what you do? You put
yes.
banana skins around
yes.
them?
Yes. Potassium.
Oh. Yeah, well, yes. Yeah. Potassium is great for flowering.
And it's a lot cheaper than tomato, right?
Gosh, or Tomerite, I think. Isn't it ever?
Now, have we done with tomatoes?
Well, all of the other problem we get is blight. Who knows what the weather's going to be like this year. But if it's wet and humid, watch out for blight, which is when the leaves and fruits go a bit mouldy. There's not a lot you can do except get rid of your plants, but don't put them on the compost.
I see.
It'll spread the fungus.
Right. So I was told, actually, because I have just bought a tomato plant.
Ooh, big spender.
And a tomato plant, yes. I'm going to give it a name, actually. I'm so fond of it already. But when I did my buying, I was faced with an enormous number of varieties.
Mm.
I bought Ulster Craig.
Yep.
And next door was Moneymaker.
Yeah, they're both good ones.
Right. And they looked to be so much stronger than a number of other tomato plants, which were sort of in the trays adjacent.
That could have just been the way they were grown. I mean, to be fair, most... Did you buy the tomatoes at the garden centre, or where did you get your tomato plants from?
A shop called, a lovely shop actually, Littlemore Ironmonger's
shop. Oh, isn't it brilliant? I love that shop.
I love the people.
They're so friendly. They're yeah. wonderful. You can buy anything in there.
And they tell you just how it is.
Yes, exactly.
Don't pay that for
exactly.
that. We've got something just as
yes.
good.
Love
and
that
it's
shop.
Half the price.
Yes, yeah. But the tomatoes, I mean, they could have been sown later, they could have been grown under slightly different conditions, but potted up, they will all grow, they should all grow really well.
And just one final question. Yes. No mow May.
Oh, yes.
You should see my meadow.
We've got a meadow.
And mine.
Ours is full of buttercups and speedwell. It looks amazing.
Mine's full of dead dandelions.
Oh no!
So anyway, no mow May, is it really going to have any effect, do you think?
Well, I mean, it will do. I mean, it's been such a miserable start to the year for insects and pollinators and wildlife in general because it's been so wet and cold. And if they've got more flowers left in our gardens, they will benefit from them. So I would urge people not to mow in June as well, or at least to leave a patch of your garden growing wild all summer.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Ruth. And I am going to have a row with my dandelions. And I am going to have a big blast at my thistles.
Well, do what my sister-in-law does and makes dandelion wine.
Well, Andy and I prefer scotch.
Yes.
But we have yet to find a way of making it.
Yeah,
we?
Absolutely.
I thought
yes.
actually if you distill granola or something like that.
That would be interesting.
Get onto eBay, I think.
Anyway, Ruth, lovely to have you with us.
Lovely to be back
so
in the studio.
For coming in. Now, where are we, Andy?
Well, thank you. Yes, Ruth, lovely to see you again. And we must move on now to our next item. And next, we broach a subject with an alarming statistic provided by the NHS. In Dorset, in the period from May 2020 to January this year, that's 8 months, 3,840 children and young people were referred for mental health support. What's behind this disturbing figure? Well, John asked Gemma Levitas, a transformational life coach and psychotherapist who has contributed to Ridgeway magazine before, for her views. Our interview includes comments about Prince Harry and his recent thoughts on the subject.
Gemma Levitas, I mean, I'm as surprised as you, possibly, on the numbers of children and young people seeking help for mental health issues. What's your take on the subject?
It's unsurprising, really. We've been through a pandemic. We're still in a pandemic. And, you know, it's unsurprising that it's affecting children and young people as much as, if not more, than adults. It's a very confusing time for everyone. And, you know, with children, that's increased because they don't necessarily have the same level of understanding as adults do of the situation. So there are all sorts of things that children haven't been allowed to do, which they normally would have done, which would be beneficial to their development, like mixing with others. And, you know, they haven't been able to do that. So it's quite unsurprising that it's impacted their mental health.
But what is it that really is sort of pointing this whole issue up? I mean, children, you know, grow up, they have to experience deprivation, they have to experience not being allowed to do what they want to do, they have to experience sort of family limits, if you like, on activities. So what is making it worse?
Well, certainly, you know, being in a pandemic means that, you know, we've all been in a state of unknown for a long period of time. It's been over a year now. And, you know, the stress and the pressure that that's put on families, that's put on parents, you know, is going to, you know, have a trickle effect. In some families, you know, quite a devastating trickle effect. People have lost their jobs. They've lost their livelihoods. They've had to change a lot of things. And that's going to have its impact on the family unit.
So do the worries and issues experienced by the parents, it could be shortage of money, it could be doubts about employment in the future, does that have some sort of trickle-down effect on children? If the parents are stressed, are the children stressed?
Often, yes, because, you know, we as parents are a mirror to our children. So if our children see us stressed, if a child sees their parents under a lot of pressure, under strain, unwell, worried, then it's going, yes, absolutely, it's going to impact on the child, particularly if the parent is overwhelmed and unable, doesn't have the resources to help manage their child's anxiety because they're struggling with their own. You know, that's definitely going to have a trickle-down effect, absolutely, because the child is witness. It bears witness to all of this.
How helpful do you think Prince Harry has been? Because, of course, the newspapers and television have given a lot of coverage to the points that he's making about mental health. And I mean, some people think that there's too much self in all this. He's self-indulgent. He's self-pitying. You know, and of course, I mean, one must bear in mind that he is a rich young man who has had, or would have had, all the advantages in life.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I think we have to also remember that, you know, Prince Harry is talking about something extremely personal to him. He's talking about his grief surrounding his mother. He's talking about his internal pain. And that's something that's quite brave to share. It takes a lot of courage to speak about your own struggles with mental health in public. You know, some people find it difficult to share it with their closest family members, let alone the world. So Prince Harry is sharing something deeply personal and deeply painful for himself in the hope that it will destigmatize mental health issues and that it will help people have a conversation, open up the conversation, make it, to be honest, make it a bit more open, something that we can admit is very common to people in their lives. You know, it's something that children have difficulty with, young people, older people, you know, throughout their lives. Mental health problems can affect anybody at any time, regardless of their status. And so I think Prince Harry is taking the shame out of it, and he's destigmatizing it. And that's really valuable and really, really important. And he does have a huge platform from which to speak. He's incredibly famous. He has this global fame. Everybody knows him as a member of the royal family. So what he's doing is extremely important and valuable, very, very brave. And whatever our personal opinions might be about whether he should or shouldn't be speaking about it, his speaking about it continues a conversation, and it keeps this subject in the light, as opposed to something that's hidden away that people might feel ashamed about. There's no shame in struggling. It happens to most people at some point in their lives, and I think that's what Harry is highlighting, and that's really, really important.
So, of course, the sort of English people, I can't speak for Scots or the Irish people, but they're famous for bottling things up, aren't they? They don't talk about these issues. I think there's a sort of phrase like, big boys don't cry, so you don't really talk about things. I mean, is this a sort of part of the sort of national psyche, or used to be? Do you think that's changes?
Yeah, I hope it is changing, because as I say, you know, it doesn't matter, regardless of age or gender or wealth or anything like that, you know, everybody at some point could be touched by mental health issues, and that might be, you know, personally for themselves, it could be a close member of their family, it could be a friend they're worried about, you know, so the more we are aware of mental health issues, and the more we're aware of the help there is available, you know, NHS services are available, we all have access to the NHS, you know, if you are worried about yourself or somebody else, you can take it to your GP, you can go and see your GP and activate the services that are available to all of us. And also, you know, there's a wealth of information around, there are a wealth of services that everybody has access to. So, you know, Harry talking about it is hopefully going some way to normalizing the fact that anybody can struggle at any point in their life, young or old, rich or poor, and that it's okay that we can talk about this and that there is help out there.
And our thanks to Gemma Levitas there for joining us today. Now, our trip down memory lane this time looks at two developments that changed roads forever, tarmac and cat's eyes. Now, for some reason, I always thought tarmac was an American invention, but not only was I wrong, but I had no idea there was a tenuous Portland connection with its invention. In ancient times, streets in towns and some villages were either cobbled with round stones or paved with stone, but elsewhere they were very much left as undressed roadways with ruts and bumps, mud and dust, subject to seasonal weather conditions. Attempts were made in early Victorian times to make a surface using a mix of sand and tar, which was compacted. The first person to see the potential of the mixture was a Scottish engineer, John London McAdam. But because at that time the surface he first invented was prone to ruts, it was only suitable for use on pavements. The next development, an improvement, was discovered, as in so many cases, by accident. In 1901, Edward Pooley, we don't know much about him except his name, was walking past an ironworks in the Midlands and noticed a very smooth stretch of road. Unusually, there were no ruts and no build-up of mud, and he wondered why. On asking, he found out that a barrel of tar had burst open on the original road surface, and in an effort to clean up the mess, waste slag from the ironworks furnaces had been poured onto it, resulting in a smooth top layer strong enough to withstand ruts caused by cartwheels. Pooley was impressed and subsequently took out a patent for a road surfacing material using tar, sand, Portland cement and aggregate mixed together before covering the road. It was compacted by steamroller, and the rest is history. Now, we have to confess to being a little liberal with the truth. Portland cement was actually invented in Leeds in the mid-1800s and got its name because the cement was the same colour as Portland stone.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106 with John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
Now, what do you suppose has been called the most brilliant invention ever produced in the interests of road safety? There might be several contenders. Take the pedestrian crossing or the traffic light, for instance. But it is generally agreed the prize should go to cat's eyes. Now, to give them their official name, when first introduced on a road in 1934, they were referred to as reflecting road studs. To this day, they make a reassuring ba-dump if you cross over the centre line in a main road. Like many inventions, it was the creative thought behind a near accident. The inventor, Percy Shaw, was a road mender by profession. He was motoring down a steep winding road near his home on a foggy night. It was in the days of trams, and he was used to the reflection of the tram lines in his car reflected by his headlights, and it helped him find his position and reassure him where he was on the road. Now, this night, in the murky conditions, there was no comforting marker. The tram lines had been taken up for repair, and as he swerved, unsure of the road, his car lights picked out two pinpricks of light ahead. As he got closer, he realised they belonged to a cat that was sitting in the road, and its eyes were reflecting the lights from his car. He set to work designing something that would replicate the cat's eyes that could be set into the road surface. Through trial and error, he patented the idea for reflecting road studs. Now, if you study cat's eyes in a road carefully, you will realise just how clever they are. Of course, they had to be tough to withstand all weathers and vehicles running over them, and Shaw's design featured four glass beads, a rubber moulding, and a cast iron base. The reflecting beads are in pairs at opposite ends of the moulding. The rubber housing and the beads are sunk into the road in a cast iron tray, and the reason they don't get dirty is because they are self-cleaning. The cast iron base collects rainwater, and as the vehicles squash the rubber housing when passing over them, the weight pushes the cat's eyes into the water and washes them. Now, the great British invention is in use throughout the world, and Shaw's company, called Reflecting Road Studs at the time, made at its peak over 1 million sets of studs a year. Later, red studs were added, which donate the edge of a road. Now, when this story was told to the late lamented comedian Ken Dodd, he observed that had Percy Shaw's cat been facing the other way, he might have invented the pencil sharpener.
Oh dear, oh dear. That's a typical Ken Dodd joke, that, isn't it? Now, another lifesaver on the roads is the pedestrian crossing. Did you know the Romans had a system for crossing roads where raised paving was placed on the thoroughfare for pedestrians to walk across? Not sure how they worked, whether the traffic had to stop, but the system survives in the ruins of Pompeii, where they were apparently in common use. Long before the motor car, the first traffic light installed in the UK was at a busy road junction in Bridge Street, Westminster, in 1868. It used semaphore arms, a bit like a railway signal, which were fixed on a post by the side of the road with arms raised and lowered by means of a pulley. When the arms were raised, the traffic had to come to a halt. The system was operated by a policeman. It worked well, up to a point. The difficulty came at night when it was impossible to see the arms. The answer was to illuminate them by gaslight using red and green lights behind glass lenses. Sadly, one night the gas leaked and caused an explosion, injuring the policeman. Now back to the Romans and their concern for pedestrian safety with a simple system of raised stone paving. In England, the first pedestrian crossings were marked in the road by shiny raised studs, which were okay when the traffic density was low. The Belisha Beacon, the yellow flashing globe on top of a black and white pole, was introduced in 1934 by Leslie Hoare Belisha, the Minister of Transport at the time. To make crossings even clearer, the familiar black and white zebra stripe markings were added to the roads shortly after. Today's high traffic volumes have brought about changes begun by the Pelican Crossing and the now familiar pedestrian-controlled crossings. Zebra crossings and Belisha beacons are being phased out on many roads in favour of push-button crossings that have central areas where pedestrians have to wait for the lights to change on either side of the road before they can cross safely.
Now, our last snippet about motoring comes from the money pages of the Sunday Times, and the article was headed "Cleaning Up the Latest Car Hire Ruse." And of course, it will be an added cost tacked on to the hire charge. It is most likely to be discovered by holidaymakers abroad, but in the nature of the thing, money-making tricks, expect it at your local car hire company soon. The trick plays on people's fears about COVID, and it works like this. A substantial charge for, and I quote, extra COVID cleaning is being levied in an effort by companies to recoup income and profit lost because of the effect of lockdowns and, of course, the lack of international traffic. Car hire companies are having to take extra precautions to clean what are called high-touch areas, which include gear sticks, steering wheels and door handles. Now, if you're looking to hire a car in Europe, you may well be given the option of an enhanced sanitisation. The vehicle and it's in addition to the regular sanitised charge. Now, just what is provided with these options is debatable, and like everything else with car rental, these are extras with considerable price differences for cleaning measures charged not only by different car rental companies, but also, and take note of this, also at various destinations. Enhanced sanitised cars may have been disinfected with ozone generators that remove particles from the air. Plastic covers may be placed on handles and inside and outside the cars that have been cleaned, and also the keys may be delivered in a plastic sterile envelope. The World Health Organization recommends simply disinfecting surfaces with soap and water or detergent when using a disinfectant, and opening the car windows for 30 minutes, and all these things are sufficient to sanitize a vehicle, and ozone generators are not really necessary. The trick that seems to be employed by car hire firms is to sanitise, now this is required, but also to sell enhanced cleaning, which does not offer much more than a rip-off charge. And now the prices, cleanliness costs. And here are some examples. Giving the sanitised charge first and the enhanced cleaning charge next. In Portugal, sanitisation is £172 and enhanced sanitising is £213 per hiring. In Alicante, it's £55 to £73 respectively, Malta £159 to £170, and in Rhodes, these sanitation measures will cost you between £180 and £224 per hiring. Checking individual car companies before travelling, but wherever you go, there'll probably be a COVID charge, so check first and don't be seduced into buying enhanced cleaning. That seems to be the message. For the record, we asked a local car hire company and leasing car hire company if they made a charge for sanitising. Andy Wright showed me a small electrically powered disinfectant generator which is left in each car for 30 minutes before hiring, and together with wiping down the touch points, the car is sanitised. And for this, there is no charge. As Andy told me, we pride ourselves on providing clean cars, and sanitising is part of the service.
From Dorchester, this is Keep 106.
Now, as if he needed an excuse, John went to Portland and the D-Day Centre, which has just reopened. Due to be unveiled shortly is a vehicle that really did help to win the war. There he was introduced to their latest exhibit, a DKW, known as a Duck, an amphibious truck built in the tens of thousands for the US Army and which played a key role landing troops and supplies during D-Day and thereafter. Only a handful are left in the world. It's been a labour of love, but the volunteers at the D-Day Centre have restored one to running order, and you'll not be only be able to see it, but also to ride on it in a few weeks' time. Centre manager John Davis, resplendent in a US Army colonel's uniform, in fact all the volunteers are authentically uniformed at the centre, tells the history of this remarkable vehicle and its possible connection to Monty.
If I said to you, Duck, DKW, would you know what I was talking about? Well, here's a man who knows all about ducks. Tell us, John.
Hiya, John. Pleased to meet you. So this, what we have here, is a World War II duck. So as you said, it's a DKW rather than a duck, as in the other word it's spelt. And these were used for ferrying mainly cargo to and from, effectively, ships to shore. Very much used in the river crossings on the Rhine and a myriad of rivers that the Allies came across on their way across to Germany through France. Also used in the Pacific. When the Mulberry went down, the Mulberry A, so the big floating harbours that were taken across by the Allies off to France, unfortunately the American one was blown around in a storm and it was irreparable. So these, thankfully, hundreds and hundreds of these took up the slack.
So let's describe a duck.
Ah, right, okay, so a duck. It's built around a GMC, so what they would call the deuce and a half, so a 2.5-ton to 3-ton truck, famed throughout history, essentially, or from the war, known for the Red Ball Express. So the Americans produced thousands, like they do with everything, thousands of these trucks. And this is based around one of those trucks. So everything, it is just one of those trucks with a boat put on the top. And when I say that loosely, it really is. So these were known to ship, I think it was 250 gallons a minute of water they had to pump out of these so they wouldn't sink. Now, I'll have to check those figures. I do believe that is right, if my memory serves correct. But it was a lot of water, because it really was just a truck with enough of a boat over it to float. So you can never have the best of both worlds.
Now, it has got bows, so it is recognisable as a boat. But tell me more about its uses, because this one has got, you believe, quite a history. And we're going back to D-Day, aren't we?
Yes, that's correct, John. So the history of this one is very interesting, and we cannot prove it, unfortunately. So one of our guys, well, after we acquired this duck, when it was sent off for the renovation work, underneath, when they stripped back all the yellow paint that had been painted over in the years, it was used for a duck tour, so hence the yellow duck, and underneath was some lettering that was found, some army lettering, and it corresponds to a picture that we found of Montgomery. He's getting out of this very duck, potentially this duck, with these very same letters on it. Now, we can't, of course, pinpoint this because the records are very sketchy and, of course, it being so old. However, potentially, this may well be one that he was used.
Now, we're sitting in this DKW, did I get that right?
Yes, you did, yeah.
Right. We're sitting in this duck and there is the steering wheel on the right, on the left-hand side, of course, because it's American. And there are loads and loads of levers. I mean, what actually propelled this vehicle?
Ah, right, yes, another very good question. And you are right, it is, yes, DKUW. So it's a duplex drive utility vehicle. Now, so these were, again, where it's based on the truck, you had front wheel drive and, of course, rear wheel drives. So this is what these levers are for. So this will take you from first front wheel to the rear wheel or to all four wheels or even six wheel drive is on this one. And that's how you change it. Hence these, what looks like a lot of handbrakes. The other one is, again, on this particular vehicle, being a boat and a truck, you had two propellers, one on either side, and they were engaged as well through the engine and through this prop that obviously, unfortunately, you can't see at home. And that then controls those as well. So to disengage the propellers, obviously on dry land, you wouldn't want those going, and vice versa in the water. You'd want those and rather than just your wheels. And that's what all the control systems are for.
So what sort of speed would this have on land and what sort of speed would it have in the water? Any ideas?
Yeah, they weren't particularly quick. That is, unfortunately, is true with all of this old kit. So on the road, I do believe they were limited, in fact, or they tried to stay to a limit of, I think, 35 to 30 miles or 30 to 35 miles an hour.
So people in Weymouth would have seen these during the war?
Oh, yes, very much so. Just along the road here, in fact, where the nature reserve now is where the Americans kept a lot of... I mean, they put that gravel, what is like a car park there, they install all of that. They put that down just to put their vehicles here, ready to ship them off on the boats to D-Day. So that's why it was put here. So they would have seen lots. We get a lot of people coming to the museum that were little children at the time, and they remember that being full of vehicles, John, full of vehicles, tanks and trucks and you name it, stories of them coming through from Dorchester, out to Weymouth, out to Portland, and it just being nose to tail.
Now this machine, this duck, has got two very heavy looking guns.
Yeah, so that's the 50 calibers. So those are famous in, well, every film you usually see these, and they make a very distinct noise. We've got one we can show you back at the museum. It's a very heavy, heavy sound, very rhythmic. And yeah, these were used for anti-aircraft. They were used for soft skin vehicles. Pretty much, if you could hit it with it, you could shoot it. Sounds a bit silly, but it's true. They were very effective. Unchanged even to now. They still use them now, and the design, as far as I know, has never been changed.
And how many personnel would this particular craft take?
Right, I mean, you can get, I do believe, I think it was rated for 30, I think, fully armed troops, or I think it was 3 tons upwards.
So let's bring ourselves up to date then, because you've got seats in this duck, and you'll be doing tours, won't you?
That's what we'd hope to, yes. That's the idea. So rather than taking it in the water, just because of safety's sake, because it is a very old vehicle, and despite the fact they were made to go in water, that was 80 years ago. So we don't want to put anybody at risk. So we are hoping that we can take this on the road and give people a little feel of what it's like to be in an open-air, original World War II vehicle.
Now, I'm going to make you a promise. I'd love to go on this duck when it's roadworthy, or when you're taking it on the road. So, can I hold you to an invitation?
Oh, I think we can manage that, John. Yes, definitely. You'll be the first one on the list.
I can't wait.
I can guarantee you that.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and thank you there to John Davis from the D-Day Centre on Portland. Well, that's all we've got time for today, everybody. As always, thank you very much for listening. We hope you found it entertaining and informative, and that you'll want to tune in again to our next edition of Ridgeway Magazine, always on a Wednesday at 11. In the meantime, from John Shepherd and me, Andy Venton, as always, take care of yourselves, and cheerio for now.
Goodbye.